Chapter 35. The Eternity Gate. The angel and the demon meet in the air, beneath a sky the colour of blood, drawing breaths that taste of murder. The first impact of blade against blade is a metallic thundercrack, while their sons wage war below, fighting and dying in the shadows of their father's wings. The Lord of the Red Sands swings, and the black blade shrieks, its steel flattened on souls. But the angel is gone, twisting away, soaring higher. Angron beats his wings, giving chase, enraged at his own cumbersome strength. It's like fighting a shadow. Each time he closes on Sanguinius, the angel rolls aside or furls his wings and drops away. Each missed swing of his sword, each failed grasp with his talons, resonates inside Angron's skull with a splash of acid. The nails bite to give him strength. This is so, but they also bite to punish him. Now more than ever, the nails bite with the sound of Horus's urgent command, begging for the angel's death. Angron, what little is left of Angron now that his soul has been transmogrified into the flesh matter of an ethereal god, has never heard Horus beg before. The weakness in the War Master's voice makes him shudder with revulsion. Sanguinius dives low, swooping towards the ground, and Angron follows. Volkite beams stab up at them both, lancing the sky. They fly through detonations that blacken the angel's armor and darken his wings, explosions that do nothing but tighten the demon's hold on incarnation. Every death taking place upon this planet, every life ending beneath them, strengthens Angron and seals his wounds. Closer he comes, closer. He can smell the sweat on his brother's skin. He can hear the drumbeat of his brother's blood. He can smell the sweetness of the angel's wounds. Sanguinius senses it. The angel veers away with a grace Angron cannot hope to match. A spread of feathered wings arrests his dive, and a slash of straight silver rips across the demon's face. There is no pain. Most of his face has been cut from his skull. But there is no pain. He experiences pain the way others might feel grief, or trauma, or frustration. To him, it is a helplessness, a wound within. It is something that cannot be tolerated, something that can only be overcome with the running of enemy blood. He's blind, his face broken by the silver sword, and without the organic receptors to process injury, it's the weakness that hurts. His eyes regenerate as he thrashes blindly with his blade. He can see again, dull and dim for another few moments, then with a clarity that defeats the ash and the dust swirling in the air. He doesn't see as a human sees. Angron sees the fire of souls, and his brother's flares brightest of all. When they meet again, it's in a killing embrace. The Lord of the Red Sands tears the angel from the sky, clutching his golden brother in his great claws, bearing Sanguinius down. They fall and fall and fall, and crash through the glassaic dome of the Martian temple atop the warmonger titan Malax Meridius. They strike the floor in a roll that would break any mortal bones, their tumbling bodies obliterating the mosaic rendering of the Opus Machina, sacred icon of the Adeptus Mechanicus and the Martian Mechanicum alike. This is a sacrilege neither brother notices. Tech priests and menials flee the dueling demigods. Neither of them notices that either. Angron gets a clawed hand around the angel's head. He beats Sanguinius's skull against the floor once, twice, thrice, and cracks web out along the tiles in stone-splitting veins. A fourth time, a fifth. There is weakness, then. Perhaps it should be pain as well, but it is most definitely weakness. Angron's grip slackens. His arm dissolves. Literally. It dissolves from the shoulder down, and the Lord of the Red Sands is thrown back as the angel rises. In Sanguinius's hands is a pistol, and the dregs of Angron's sentience recognize this as the melter weapon Infernus, a one-use thing of incineration. The angel casts it aside and takes wing, diving right at the demon, leading with his sword. Angron raises his own blade, feeling the flow of the incoming blows like promises whispered in warning, and he catches each of the angel's thrusts before they can impact against him. Metal grinds, sparks spray, arcing out from the meeting blades, hypnotic in their falling beauty. For a moment, just a moment, He is on the plains of Deshrajen, camping rough beneath the pale moon, watching fireflies play above the banked campfires of his freed slave army. How peaceful that night had been, even with the nails knuckling into the back of his brain. How peaceful that one night was before the Emperor tore him away from his real brothers and sisters, the siblings of his heart and not of manufactured blood, leaving them to fight alone, leaving them to die, leaving him to face this unwanted life and... Sanguinius impales him. A lance of ice runs through where his heart should be. The two brothers are face to face, one of them a visage of bloodied human perfection, the other a construct of absolute inhumanity, rage made manifest. As close as they are, despite the changes to Angron's vision, he sees the tiredness etched on the angel's features, the faint cuts and scratches that the battle for Terra has written onto Sanguinius's flesh, indelibly marking him. This war has rendered the perfect imperfect. Die, Sanguinius tells him, with the gentleness of giving a great gift. I free you from this torment. Angron's lips peel back in the memory of a smile. He tries to speak. Speaking is difficult, not because he is dying, but because he is no longer a creature for whom speaking is a natural or necessary process. Speech is an echo from a lost life. The Lord of the Red Sands expresses himself in slavering roars and the death of his foes. Sanguinius sees this, sees the way Angron's face twists, trying to remember how to form words, sees that the demon is not dying. The Lord of the Red Sands moves, but the angel is faster. Sanguinius tears the blade free and leaps upward, taking to the sky, bleeding, laughing, the demon follows. They swoop between the temple towers that rise from the back of Malax Meridius. They break away into open sky. Sanguinius is slower in the open, but he is built for this. He is graceful and experienced and born for aerial warfare. Angron has the unreal strength of demonic muscle, but he is a gargoyle chasing a hawk. Sanguinius weaves and soars and dives out of his clutches and...
Kill him!
Horus, inside the demon's mind. The words are bloated by the pantheon, ripe with the borrowed power of the gods. Behind those words is the promise of pain. True pain. Nails pain. The Lord of the Red Sands beats his wings harder, his sword leaving a trailing wake of screaming souls, the dead of terror singing their song. They race low to the ground, hardly an arm's reach above the heads of their warring sons, fast enough that their armies are an indistinct blur. Angron swings the black blade. He gouges earth. He sends blood angels and world eaters tumbling across the ground, their bodies destroyed, their souls spilling into the warp's million waiting maws. Without warning, Sanguinius climbs, soars.
This is your chance. What you were born and reborn for.
The Lord of the Red Sands ignores Horus's puling. He senses Sanguinius tiring and sees it in the flicker of his soul fire. His brother's spirit ripples with the desperate sweetness of exhaustion. The war, the battlement, the bane of the ninth bloodline. Yes, the angel's strength is running dry. The demon gathers speed, flying into the polluted wind, while anti-air fire stitches the air around him. Sanguinius weaves aside from the blinding slashes of lascannon beams, rolls away from the juddering passage of a legion stormbird. Angron, far less manoeuvrable, crashes into it, goes through it, tastes the flavour of those doomed souls as their craft comes apart around them. It is nothing to him, the expenditure of a breath's worth of effort. Behind him, the stormbird falls from the sky, its hull aflame and cleaved in two. The largest piece of its structure will tumble against the side of the Sanctum Imperialis, detonating against the thickest void shields ever created. Wreckage will rain upon the warriors of both sides. Angron knows none of this, will never know it.
Do not fail me, Angron.
The babbling of a frightened creature speaking as though it were in control. The Lord of the Red Sands pays it no heed. They dive through the death cloud of a falling titan, into black smoke and the white fire of plasma. The billowing smoke cannot hide the light of the angel's soul. Angron is close, close, close enough that he parts his jaws to reveal uneven rows of mismatched teeth that jut up from bleeding gums. As they circle in this burning, choking sphere that only burns and chokes one of them, the demon gives a draconic roar. The sound is exultant and instinctive. It is unfiltered emotion, and it reeks more of triumph than rage. Angron's mouth is still open when the spear, hurled from the angel's left hand, strikes. It shatters most of the demon's teeth, severs his tongue at the throat root, and punches through the back of his head. With the cervical segments of his spine reduced to ectoplasmic chunks, Angron falls, boneless, stunned, from the sky. The angel twists in the smoke and follows his brother down. Angron hits the Royal Ascension with cratering force at the heart of the two warring legions. His impact kills almost 100 warriors on both sides, but this is another concern outside the shreds of his sentience. The surviving World Eaters cheer him through the dust. They bay at him like loyal hounds, but he knows nothing outside his own fury. He claws at the spear. He roars around its impaling length. In these helpless seconds, he's beast-stupid in sound and action, thrashing in the dirt. The lance comes free, slick with ichor pretending to be blood, gobbets of demonic flesh sizzling on its silver surface. Already the demon is reforming, re-knitting, sustained by whatever metaphysical processes fuel his existence. The Lord of the Red Sands throws the weapon away in time to meet its wielder. The angel descends with a silence that stinks of false righteousness, as though he were a creature too enlightened to feel rage. The brothers collide in the crater they made. Around them the battle for the Eternity Gate rages. The World Eaters are coming. The World Eaters and the Life Takers and the Bloodletters. Sanguinius senses them draw near, hears their howling. Angron sees this awareness dawn in his brother's eyes. Sanguinius hacks and hacks and hacks as the snarls of chain axes and demon blades grow louder. It isn't enough. The angel launches away, a crack of his wings carrying him upward. The Lord of the Red Sands knows he can't catch Sanguinius in the sky. He scrambles for the fallen spear, draws it back, and this time there is no chase. This time, Angron is ready. He throws the spear, still slathered in ichor from when he tore it out of his own throat. The second he casts it, it rips through the air with a concussive drumbeat, breaking the sound barrier. The angel rolls aside with the grace of the Skyborn, dodging this streak of bladed intent. No, Angron sees. Not dodging. Faster than the human eye can follow, the angel has caught his spear as it passed, rolled with the momentum, and now he casts it back to the ground with a cry of effort. Angron will catch it, this twig of a thing, and... He clutches nothing but air, and the force of a meteor hits him in the chest, throwing him down, pinning him to the warp-stained ground. For several unreal seconds, the Lord of the Red Sands is impaled in place, speared through the chest. There is no pain, only humiliation. He frees himself in time to see Sanguinius ascending, leaving him behind. His wounds close, but slower, slower, slower than before. The nails bite harder, despising his weakness. Angron turns his back on his brother, seeking the lesser blood angels in Legion Red. He wades through them, ending them, sending their bodies flying back with heaving swings of his soul-thirsty sword. If he cannot catch the angel, he will lure the angel back to him. He learned this from the Bane. It takes no time at all. Angron has scarcely begun to shed blood before he hears the descending beat of angelic wings. The Lord of the Red Sands wipes the writhing bodies of dying blood angels from where they're spitted upon his blade, and turns to meet his brother once more. Bolt shells impact against him, chainswords carve into the unmeat of his legs. He ignores this, the pitiful defiance of his nephews with their bolters and chainswords. He will kill them and devour them and offer up their skulls to the Skull Throne. Yes, but now, first, the angel must die. The brothers go at one another, sword to sword. They are a blur to the mortals around them, so swift are the clashes of their blades that their swords sing a single extended note, a lasting ring without crescendo or diminuendo. It is beautiful, that ululating chime. A masterpiece of broken physics. But only one of them is immortal. Sanguinius, failed by mortal muscle, weakened by the war, begins to slow. His thrusts become deflections. His hacks shift to parries. He gives ground, at first by centimetres, then with greater steps. Through eyes tense with effort, he sees that he's being driven back towards the violated Eternity Gate. The Lord of the Red Sands sees it dawn on the angel's face, how the longer they fight, the weaker only one of them becomes. In the searing thresh that passes for Angron's mind, he knows it will come, any moment now, when desperation will force his brother's hand. Blades clash. They clash. They clash and clash and clash, and then... Angron lets the silver sword run through him, taking it inside his demonic corpus as a sacrifice. He uses the blow, feeding off the pain and craving the damage because it lets him get closer. Ooze bubbles through the cage of his teeth, the ectoplasm that animates him running from his body in a flow of lifeblood. But no matter, it's worth it. A taloned hand snaps around the angel's throat. The other thrusts forward with his blade. Deep in Ultima Segmentum, there was a planet that was not, in truth, a planet. A sphere of debris coalesced to form a planetary crust, but the world's deeper layers were saturated in a metanatural churn of etheric energy. This broken bauble, in the shape of a world, was called Sarum. It was liberated during the Great Crusade by the Eaters of Worlds, and it had supplied the bulk of that legion's arms and armour ever since its blood-stained saviours left in liberation. The most accurate description of Sarum would be to say it was a prison in the shape of a planet. Inside its core was bound a demon of immense strength and cunning, the source of Sarum's hollowed-out corruption. Lesser reflections of this abomination, shards, if you will, children, if you prefer, spread themselves across the planet, bound in secret by the Mechanicum at the hearts of their subterranean forge cities. Several years ago, a flicker of time in the grand scheme of things, a blade was forged within the hallowed underground halls of the Sacorax Foundry, laced with techno-ritualistic runes that bound a coven of warring demons within its edge. The sword was shaped to be a blight on the physical universe, the blackened metal of its blade at odds with all corporeality. Like the strongest of the Neverborn's trillion conjured breeds, it destabilized the world around its presence, growing stronger with each soul it swallowed. Finishing it cost the lives of several artisans, devouring them in the process of its construction. And after it left the forge fires, according to ritual lore, it was quenched in the blood of several hundred slaves. These slaves were captives of the Great Crusade's expeditionary fleets, shuttled back to Sarum on the secret orders of high-ranking elements within the priesthood of Mars. This length of ensorcelled brass was known as Furagath in the biomechanical tongue of Sarum, the Black Blade. It was the Mechanicum's gift to Angron upon his ascension to immortality, simultaneously honouring his triumph at the end of the path, and further heightening his place upon it. By the time the two Primarchs faced one another at the Eternity Gate, it had tasted the blood of over a million Terran souls. It had slain innocents and soldiers, adults and children, humans and Astartes. The sword, like its wielder, and like the god that owned its wielder's soul, cared not from whence the blood flowed. With every drop of blood melted into its metal length, with every soul pulled in by the creatures thirsting inside the blade, its acidic effect on reality grew fiercer. The weapon was now almost as toxic as the creature that carried it, with a similar exertion of mutation and hostility on reality. The Black Blade's makers would have rejoiced, albeit in the ways of their austere and murderous rituals, to know their creation would one day taste the blood of the great angel. Sanguinius jerks as the sword slides, with miserable slowness, into his guts. His perfect features darken with pain, and the Lord of the Red Sands feeds on that sight, feeds on the angel's baring of teeth, feeds on the stink of Sanguinius's rich running blood. The sensation is narcotic, intoxicatingly pure. Even the god of war, in whose shadow Angron stands, bays with pleasure at the shedding of this being's blood. Angron's grip tightens on the angel's throat. He thrusts the blade deeper, growling at the fresh flow of blood that bursts from his brother's mouth. Sanguinius's mouth works, but at first no words come forth. All he manages to breathe out is his brother's name.
Brother!
It is a struggle for Angron to speak, but a lifetime of bitterness is dredged with the agony in his brother's beautiful eyes. He sinks the blade deeper into the angel's body, hilting it in his brother's guts, and draws Sanguinius in until they're face to face. He's close enough to smell the blood on his brother's breath. He's close enough for it to spatter against his face.
Angron!
No sound in life has ever been sweeter than his flawless, beloved, exemplar brother hissing his name in strangulation. Angron's jaws are poorly shaped for human speech, but the Lord of the Red Sands forces the words from his maw.
Hark! The dying angel sings.
Sanguinius reaches for him with weak and clawless hands. It's pathetic. The performance of a weakling. The Lord of the Red Sands doesn't need to breathe. He cares nothing if his brother's hands find their way around his throat. But the sweetness is fading. The adrenal rush drains away. Is this truly how the angel dies? Is this all the fight Sanguinius has left in his celebrated form?
Angron.
Horus, the War Master, the coward in orbit. The Lord of the Red Sands hears the voice break through his ecstatic haze and senses Horus has been seeking to reach his blood-soaked mind for some time. There is derision in the War Master's presence, but above all, there is fear.
Release him! Release him! He is...
Sanguinius's reaching hands close on a fistful of the cranial cables that crown Angron's head. The angel grips the technological dreadlocks that form the external regulators of the butcher's nails, and the beast that Angron has become realizes too late, much too late, the angel has played the same gambit, risking a blade, welcoming it to get close.
Kill him before...
The words cease to exist, replaced by pain, real pain, a thing he thought he was incapable of experiencing, now stunning in its unfamiliar savagery. The Lord of the Red Sands gives a roar loud enough that the Sanctum's void shields shimmer with a mirage's ripple. He tears his blade from his brother's body, grappling, hurling, but the angel remains. White wings batter at the demon's face and defeat the raking of his claws. He abandons his own blade to scratch and scrape at the angel. He tears away shards of golden armor. Wings bleed, feathers rain. Never once does Sanguinius make a sound. Angron cries out, a cry flavored by something other than rage for the first time since his exaltation. Agony lightning bolts through his head. Fire and ice and fire. A sensation he no longer has the mind to understand. But that will destroy him, whether he understands it or not. He launches upward, beating his ungainly wings, striving for the sky, turning and tumbling, seeking to dislodge the straining angel. On the battlefield below, the legions duel in the rain of their Primarch's blood. The Lord of the Red Sands.
Angron! I remember now. I am Angron!
Feels his skull creaking, stretching. Then a crack that paints the back of his eyes with acid. It's the cracking of a slowly breaking window, the crack of a skull under a tank's treads. He hears his brother now, Sanguinius's ragged hisses of breath, coming in time to the scrape of his gauntlet against the pain engine's mechanical tendrils. Their eyes meet, and there is no mercy in the angel's pale gaze. Sanguinius is lost to the passions he has always resisted. The Lord of the Red Sands sees it in the pinpricks of his brother's pupils, in the ivory grind of his brother's fangs. The angel has lost himself to blood need. The veins show starkly blue on his cheeks. This is wrath. This is the angel unleashed. It is an anger so absolute, Angron feels the bite of another forgotten emotion. Jealousy. What he sees in the angel's eyes is no bitter fury at a life of mistreatment, or rage goaded by the will of a god that only rewards slaughter. It feeds the god of war, as all bloodshed does, but it is not born of him. It is the angel's own fury, in worship of nothing but justice. How beautiful that is! How naive! How pure! This is the demon's last cohesive thought. Fueled by animal panic as much as sentient rage, Angron's frantic clawing does nothing to throw Sanguinius clear. The brothers fall together, the demon's strength lost to convulsive thrashing, the angel's ripped and blood-stained wings unable to keep them both aloft. The dreadlock cables are fastened deep in the meat of the monster's mind. They are not attached to the brain, they are part of it, tendrilling their way through the pain engine that replaced and so poorly simulated entire sections of the 12th Primarch's cerebellum, thalamus and hypothalamus. The butcher's nails are woven throughout his brainstem, hammered in to bind them to the spinal column and central nervous system. It is a process almost admirable in its barbaric effectiveness, one reproduced with malignant perfection in his exaltation from a mortal to an immortal. From behind the veil, Angron hears laughter. A god, laughing at him because it cares not from whence the blood flows. The death of the Lord of the Red Sands is as pleasing to this divinity as the death of any other champion. Warp fire flares from the cracks in the beast's deforming skull. The cracks become crunches, each one a conflagration that sweeps from the filaments behind Angron's eyes to the spikes of his spine. There is the feeling of violation, a deep and slick wrongness, as something is taken from him, pulled from the root of his mind. He screams then, and he does something he has never done in neither his mortal nor immortal lives. His roar of pained rage is coloured by a sound so shameful he will spend the rest of eternity refusing to believe it happened. The sound is a word, and the word is a plea. He begs.
No!
The beast grunts to his brother. This moment will never enter the legends of either legion. The Primarchs are high above the battlefield, and the few sons able to watch their fathers are too far away to know what passes between them. Only Sanguinius hears Angron's last word, and it is an intimacy he will take to his grave. The ground rises with disorientating speed. It's now or never. As they freefall together, the angel gives a final wrenching pull on the serpents of barbarian metal. The demon's head bursts. It's a detonation, a release of internal pressure like pus from a squeezed cyst. The lion's share of Angron's brain comes free in a spray of fire and acid blood. The demon's wings beat once more, just a shiver, a thing of reflex. His claws slacken. All struggles cease. Sanguinius throws himself free of the falling corpse, spreading his wounded wings, first for stability, then for altitude. Beneath him, the demon strikes the avenue of stairs, shaking the royal ascension and stealing what little reason remains to the gladiator warriors of the 12th Legion. A twinned cry rises to where he beats his wings above the battlefield. The blood angels fight with renewed hope, seeing their father victorious, the slayer of demons. The world eaters, racked by the psychic backlash of their slain sire, see the emperor's angel haloed by the rising red sun. Inzar was close to the top of the ascension, surrounded by world-eaters and deep in the shadow of the sanctum, when the body struck the earth. The corpse of the Lord of the Red Sands crashed upon the stairs leading to the Eternity Gate, breaking open on the steps of marble and gold. The earth quaked with the impact, and in its wake, the chaplain heard a colossal cry rise from the throat of every living world-eater. This lamentation wasn't wholly physical, but something blasphemous, he felt, in the creases of his mind.
Demigods should not die, he thought,
as that awful cry rose to the haloed angel above them. Inzar's breathing was uneven, hastened by adrenaline but weighed with fatigue. He felt the ache of wounds he couldn't remember suffering, the hundreds of incidental cuts and stabs that took place in the grinding of battle lines. Warriors of the myriad legions clashed everywhere around them in rapid packs, all cohesion lost, but always the War Master's tide had pressed forward. Until now. He looked ahead, past the dead whale grotesquerie of Angron's smashed corpse, to where the gate still stood open. Beyond that open portal lay victory. Wounded squads of Blood Angels were still falling back through the doors, firing at the advancing horde.
"Forward!" Inzar cried. "Forward for the Pantheon! Death to the false Emperor!"
He levelled his Crozius at the Eternity Gate and sought to urge the blood-maddened warriors around him onward through force of will and prayer. The Colchisian tattoos across his face started weeping blood.
"Breacher!"
one of the nearby world-eaters grunted. Frantic now, desperate for any ally, Inzar turned to him. He didn't know the warrior. He was just one of thousands in the stalled tide. The chaplain met the man's eyes, not unlike the meeting of gazes that took place in the sky between two demigod brothers only minutes before. For the first time, Inzar learned what it was to have the bloodshot glare of nails madness turned upon him. In that stare, he saw not just the absence of reason, but the death of it.
"Kill!"
the warrior snarled, his vocal cords thick with blood, mucus, or both.
"Come with me. We can still rally the others and maim!"
The world-eater's gaze was bare of comprehension.
"I am Inzar of the 17th Legion. Hear me and heed me. Rise, and we can end this. We are so close."
The world-eater seemed to understand. He reached out a hand as if to make an oath. Inzar took it.
"Burn!"
The world-eater pulled on the preacher's hand as he brought the axe up, chain teeth revving. There was no resistance. The chain axe went through the joint like it went through bone, and it went through bone like water. Inzar staggered back, his arm amputated at the elbow, and crashed into another warrior behind him. He had a fraction of a second to see the death guard he'd backed into, going down beneath the hacking axe of another world-eater. It was a scene repeated in woeful plenitude wherever Inzar turned. The world-eaters were falling upon their own allies, howling, cutting, killing.
"Blood for the blood god! Kill, maim, burn! Skulls for the skull throne!"
The world-eater forced him back, stumbling over the slain. Inzar fought one-armed, swinging his Crozius, facing a foe that moved so swiftly he could only process what the warrior was doing after it was done. The legionary didn't dodge or defend. He chopped at the haft of the Crozius, severing it, and on the backswing he relieved the word-bearer of his other arm, ending it at the shoulder. The next swing went into Inzar's stomach, liquefying his intestines in a roar of chain teeth. The next cleaved down into Inzar's breastplate, the teeth churning with exquisite brutality, chewing through the layers of ceramite, muscle, bone, and organ meat. Inzar's retinal display went red with the gush of blood he vomited into his helmet. Combat narcotics and meditative focus couldn't deaden the excruciation of insides ground into mince, but the pain was secondary to the insane clarity that gripped him. The more he was carved apart, the colder and clearer everything became. He thought, against the reality of what was happening,
"Wait, do not do this."
Then a moment later,
"We can still win. We can still..."
Through red-stained vision, greying at the edges, he saw the world-eater towering above him.
"Have I fallen?" Inzar wondered. "Am I on my back?"
More of them drew in, clawing at each other, lost to madness in the aftermath of their Primarch's death. One of them was convulsing hard enough that his weapon chain rattled against his warplate. He was the one to look down at the fallen word-bearer, and he grinned with blood-streaked metal teeth. Inzar saw the axe's teeth cycling, cycling, and descending. He heard the gods laughing as he died, and for the first time there was no comfort in the sound. They were laughing at him. They'd always been laughing at him. Lotara Sarin bore mute witness as the vox web and its attuned hololiths erupted in impossibilities. The Conqueror's command deck hadn't seen this level of activity in months, with officers and ratings moving to consoles that came back to flawed life. She moved from station to station, watching footage from the surface that couldn't be real, hearing reports in panicked voices she could barely understand.
Someone get me a clear report of what's going on down there.
Lutara was revolted at her own shaking tone.
Helm, negative barriers, and roll us to Earthrise.
The ship obeyed slowly. The armoured shutters protecting the bridge's gigantic windows withdrew, immediately admitting the warp's seething unlight. Rolling back the barriers changed nothing. The surface was hidden in the warp's tides, leaving them relying on hololiths.
Any word?
She called across the deck. The surviving bridge crew were absorbed in their tasks, trying to make sense of what they were seeing themselves. She cursed the loss of her executive officer and practically everyone else of worthy rank. A wave of nausea washed over her. She was getting angry, and her malnourished frame was punishing her for it. When had she last eaten? Or last tasted pure water? Throne, how many times had she asked herself those questions since reaching Terra? Lutara rubbed gummy eyes and tried to refocus. Slowly she made her way to her throne, turning away at the last moment with a dry heave. Like the rest of the bridge, it was matted with a rime of bloody matter, and glancing at it made her eyes ache, fit to burst. She lowered herself to the deck instead, sitting on the stairs of her raised dais. The only way she could still her trembling hands was by bunching them into fists and pressing her knuckles to the grimy iron floor. The hololithic displays kept coming, spooling out images with only the scarcest sense from the shouted reports. Lutara watched, piecing it together where she could. Her eyes were wide pools, reflecting the scrolling hololithic words. Angron was dead. Sanguinius had torn the crown from Angron's head and cast the 12th Primarch's body down the steps of the sanctum. That alone was madness to countenance. She'd never have believed it without the scratchy picked footage from helmet feeds, showing Angron's immense form crashing to earth and rupturing open. The World Eaters had lost the last of their senses, berserk beyond sentience with the death of their father. Report after report cited the World Eaters turning on their own side and on each other in mindless butchery. The reports of Angron's humiliating death came not from the Legion, but from the human elements in Sanctum Imperialis Palatine, somehow still unslaughtered. Other hololiths showed warriors of the Thousand Suns Legion undergoing changes. Thousands of them were suffering rapid onset of mutation, flesh bursting from their armour, sending them into frenzies of psychic violence. The world was turning to stone and glass and meat around these unfortunates. At first, no one knew why. Was this the Sigilite's work? The wrath of the Emperor? The displeasure of the gods? No, she knew, though she couldn't say how she knew. It was purely that nothing else made sense. Magnus is dead too. Lutara's attempts to reach any World Eater's officers on the ground met with abject failure. She got screams, she got static, she got howls that suggested a kind of pain she never wanted to know. Lutara stopped trying. She watched the hololiths with their carnivals of massacre and mutation. Two Primarchs dead. Two legions lost to madness in the same moment. Only one World Eater remained calm. Khan, kneeling at Lutara's side, wordlessly watched Terra burn on the Oculus. He had no interest in the hololiths beaming above the crew consoles. He was wholly unmoved by the crackling reports. He just watched the world slowly turn, slowly burn. When a link to the surface came, it was riven by distortion. Lutara stared at the image resolving on the Oculus. The thing she was speaking with was a legless amalgamation of three people, fused to the floor and sides of its cockpit with arches of bone and pulsing red flesh. Its arms were stalks and cables, forming power feeds to various machinery. It looked at her with six eyes and answered her with three mouths, none of which were remotely human anymore. Strain coloured the creature's words, effort clear in its voices.
This is Princeps Ullian Gruner of Ortex. I command Hindara. Angron is dead. The assault is failing. We cannot keep the gate open without immediate reinforcement.
Most of the creature was dead. Entire portions of its amalgamated body were necrotic, mottled with the onset of rot. The way it was attached to its surroundings seemed to be sustaining it somehow, but not enough to keep all its extremities alive. Four of its six eyes looked milky, at best blind, more likely decaying. The feed wasn't clear enough to be sure.
"Sacred hell,"
Lutara said under her breath.
"The angel,"
it said, and its voices drained away into a groan of effort. The thing's three tongues, two of which were black and sporting what looked like puncture holes from careless fangs, briefly licked across the lower half of its face.
"We cannot."
The oculus went black. The command deck's lights, already dull with power drainage, glowed a sudden emergency red. It had been so long since the ship went to battle stations that it took the malnourished crew several seconds to realize and react. "Voids to full," Lotara called. But several officers were already working at it, lighting the generators from minimal layering to active shielding. When the ship shivered, it was with incoming fire splashing against her voids, not the deeper rumbles of impact damage.
"Who the hell is firing on us?"
Lutara rose to her feet before her throne, feeling more like herself than she had in months. Her mind was beginning to pick up speed again.
"Betrayal," she thought.
"Someone in the fleet is firing upon us, and someone in the fleet is going to die. Helm, bring us out of geostationary orbit and summon the rostered escort squadron to our side. Kindle the auxiliary reactors and run out the guns. Whoever is firing at us is about to regret it."
One of the ratings by the master of Vox Station held a hand to his cabled earpiece.
"Speak,"
Lutara commanded him.
"The whole fleet is under attack,"
he called, looking past Lutara.
"Address me," she ordered, "not my throne."
The officer's eyes unfocused as he processed the conflicting voices of several dozen officers aboard several dozen vessels.
"The attack isn't coming from another ship. It's coming from the surface. A sustained cannonade against the entire fleet."
Lutara's blood ran cold. There was only one installation on the surface capable of...
"Pull us out of range. Shield us with our secondary squadrons and open a channel to the vengeful spirit."
The Conqueror juddered around them, its engines forcing a slow rise. The void shield trembles kept coming.
"The flagship is holding position in the upper atmosphere,"
the console officer paused.
"And its shields are down."
Lutara turned to the man.
"What?"
"The flagship shields are down."
"Minimal layering?"
"No."
He was addressing her throne again instead of her.
"They're entirely lowered."
The oculus flared to life again in a blizzard of harsh static. It resolved part way, showing the silhouette of the vengeful spirit. Vessels of all classes around it were rolling, pockmarked with barrage damage, pulling up out of their bombardment positions to escape the firestorm lancing up from the surface. The flagship alone held its place. It was untouched. Ships in close formation were igniting, burning as they strove to fly free, but the vengeful spirit remained, impossibly unharmed.
"Incoming signal,"
called the rating, assuming Master of Vox duties. The central hololithic table powered up again, projecting the stern image of a Legion warrior wearing the white of Jagatai Khan's white scars. His revolving image painted every upturned face a flickering blue.
"I am Shibban Khan of the 5th Legion, honored to currently hold the mantle of Regent Commander of the Lionsgate Spaceport. I address this message to the fleet of treasonous dogs laying claim to the skies of Terra. You will find Lionsgate's surface-to-orbit defenses are once again operational. Message ends."
The hololith vanished. He was gone. Lutara almost laughed. Blood of the Emperor, but she admired his attitude. Exhilarated now, she turned to retake her throne for the first time in weeks. Lutara approached the great seat of twisted metal and froze.
"Don't look," Khan told her.
He was still unarmed, his armor ruined by the blows that had killed him. But she'd already looked. Now she couldn't look away. There was a murderous thing sitting in her throne. A thing with shining black eyes and malevolent flesh, as if some perverse whim had granted a loosely human form to the ship itself. The thing in her throne wore her uniform, with her red hand symbol on its slender chest. Its hair was a ratty snarl of greying black. Its mouth was a split-lipped slit, housing an arsenal of sore teeth. It was captivating in the way apex predators were captivating. It radiated the same lethality. And it was joined to the throne. From the immersion of its limbs in the dark metal chair, it had been joined here for months. Its unpleasantly human head swung left, then right, the slits of its nose flexing as it sniffed the air, brazen as any beast. It looked hungry. It looked vampiric.
"It is Lotara, Sarin," said Khan.
Lotara backed away from the thing. It paid her no heed, its lidless eyes blinking with wet flickers of blood-soaked membranes. Claws the length of knives clickety-clicked on the arms of the metal throne.
"Signal the vengeful spirit,"
said the thing in Lotara Sarin's throne, in a rasping approximation of Lotara Sarin's voice.
"Inform the War Master. We stand ready."
The crew obeyed the thing at once, showing no fear, only weary obedience. She remembered the War Master's words days before. "You are not Lotara Sarin." Lotara turned to Khan, saying it because she had to say it, not necessarily because she believed it.
"That's not me. I am Lotara Sarin."
"You are a wraith,"
said the throne-bound huntress. Her voice was pitched snake-low, sibilant, not without sympathy.
"You are the conqueror's memory of Lotara Sarin. You are the machine spirit's echo of what once was, given false life along with the other ghosts that walk the halls of my ship."
"I am Lotara Sarin,"
Lotara said again, her firmer tone only making her sound more desperate.
"You are not even the first of my spectres,"
the huntress promised, and sincerity gleamed in her black eyes.
"The conqueror conjures you along with the others over and over. It brings back the dead that it remembers and the living that have now changed. The crew is plagued by their former incarnations. These hauntings are just one of the ship's many madnesses as it awakens here in the warp. I was polite to the first few of you. I try to ignore you now. It upsets you when you learn the truth."
"I am Lotara Sarin,"
she said one more time, the words breathless, escaping her lips as vapour.
"Do you know what I think you really are?"
The huntress tilted her head, considering the ghost before her.
"You are my weakness, cut from me. You are my amputated doubts, echoing through my ship. You are the part of me that wanted to run from the conqueror."
"I am Lotara Sarin,"
she thought, finding she couldn't give voice to the fading claim. The wraith was growing faint now. Lotara ignored it as she reclined in her filthy throne. There would be another one, and doubtless soon, drifting its deluded way down the ship's haunted hallways. It too would exert minor control over the ship's systems, thinking itself mistress of the conqueror.
"Incoming message,"
called her master of Vox.
"Text only. Pulse beam from an extrasolar location. The fleet has intercepted it from reaching Terra."
Lotara welcomed the contact with a flicker of her talons. A message from beyond the Sol system. Today was shaping up to be a day of significant goings-on. She brought up the message on the gore-crusted screen built into the arm of her throne and ran her black orb eyes over the words. Quite unintentionally, her bloody lips peeled back from the ivory daggers she had for teeth.
"Who knew the Lord of the 13th Legion could be so sentimental?"
She breathed the words through strings of blood-pinked saliva.
"Keep blocking the signal. Don't let it reach the surface."
Sanguinius lands with his back to the Eternity Gate. He has passed beyond all of exhaustion's miseries and burned through the reserves of his body. He has accrued wounds, incidental and grievous, layering them upon each other month after month, leaving him a patchwork revenant beneath armour of broken gold. Two of his sons come to him, bearing his fallen sword and his golden spear. To Sanguinius's shame, in his pain, he does not recognize them by the sigils on their armor. He thanks them nonetheless, accepting the blade en carmine. For now he foregoes the spear. Whatever malefaction was in the flames that erupted from Angron's skull, Sanguinius's hand is a seared ruin. His fingers curl in the charred shell of his gauntlet, but the flexion is tight and the ligaments weak. This is far from the worst of his wounds, but he cannot confront the truly grievous one yet. He can only feel it, spreading through his bloodstream like burning venom, crystallizing in his joints, making it harder to breathe. His brother would never use venom. This is something else, something worse. He still carries Angron's crown, the butcher's nails. The bioetheric matter in Sanguinius's fist is a wretched squid of wet steel. It trails lesser cords and shards of spinal bone like trophy ribbons. He turns the parasite engine over, the cause of such grief, such strife, and sees the last flickers of tainted electrical signals sparking along the vascular cables. Hanging from razor wire strings are his brother's bloodstained eyes. Sanguinius casts a final look over the War Master's horde, the beasts still charging closer, the World Eaters lost in butchering each other, the Titans gearing up to fire upon their own side if it gives them even a whisper's chance of hitting him. They vent their rage on the Sanctum's voids, doing nothing but painting the air around the Eternity Gate with prismatics and fractals. The Royal Ascension is warping, shifting with great cracks of mutating marble. The statues lining the avenue twist to become icons of sin. The ground splits and blackens at its burning edges, and the army of humanity's afterlife claws its way from the underworld. The gods are here. Real or not, they are here.
The gate!
The custodians and his own sons cry at him.
Seal the gate! Seal the gate!
They fight and die all around him, some close enough to touch, some cut down here in the 11th hour, some shedding blood in this last desperate retreat. Those that pass into the shadows of the sanctum will live, for now. Those that remain outside. So many are yet too far to make it back, dying by degrees lower down on the platform steps of the Royal Ascension. They fight on, encircled, doomed. It breaks his heart to see such valour, and to know he must turn his back on it.
Sire!
One of his sons calls in the flood of retreating warriors. It is the bringer of sorrow, the one who exiled himself to terror in shame, fighting at the side of the flesh-tearer. Two sons that failed him in better times, making him proud now all is almost lost. He loves them as he loves all his legion, and though he would never give it voice, his heart always goes out most to the disappointments, the ones that struggle to reach the perfection the others take for granted.
Sire!
Zephon calls as he fights at his brother's side, in his father's shadow. Despair twists his familiar features.
The gate!
Wings flex, no longer white. They're scorched, featherless in places, raked bloody in others. And Sanguinius launches upward, sword in one hand, the butcher's nails in the other. One by one, he severs the chains. Some snap in a single blow, others take a second hack to cleave through. But Ordak's iron gives way against the fall of the Primarch's blade. Freed, the gate's engines grind again. The last blood angels that will make it through do so at a dead run. Not all of them make it. Some choose to turn, to fight, to buy a last few seconds for their brothers. Sanguinius lands between the closing doors. For a moment, he does not know which way he will walk. Back into the sanctum, or back out into the battle with those who have chosen to remain as rearguard and fight to the end, and the death. He knows what he wants to do, but he knows what he must do. The Emperor's angel throws the wreckage of his brother's brain to the ground and crushes it beneath his boot. Then he turns his back on the war outside, and the Eternity Gate seals behind him with a crash that cuts him to his core. The past is on one side of that sound. Fate is on the other.